You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, Heat Nation, and welcome to your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, the only podcast that breaks down every game, news item, rumor, and more. Thank you for subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or on Himalaya. My name is David Ramil. It's the day after Miami's biggest win of the season over the Milwaukee Bucks. I was thinking about that podcast yesterday and kind of seeing all the different reactions to it. And, you know, I want to say that it was a little difficult recording under those circumstances. I've done it before, but the emotions of the game, because it was such an intense game over such a quality opponent, I don't think I was as focused as I could be. I was listening to parts of the podcast and I was a little scattered as far as my opinions were concerned. And I do apologize for that, because I do want to get the best show possible together for you, because, well, frankly, you deserve it. But I was thinking about not just my own reactions to the podcast, but the national reaction to it the following day. And I think a lot of people are still discounting what happened, because it is just a regular season game. It was on the second night of a back-to-back. I think a lot of people are seeing that it was an aberration, that it was a typical game for Milwaukee, because they've been so dominant all season long. And I think for Milwaukee's fans' perspective, one, obviously, they've been very critical of the officiating, but they also, as a lot of fan bases, as almost every fan base tends to be, they're very sensitive about the fact that people are pointing out that it was a loss when they've been so successful for most of the season, and hardly anybody's ever talked about that. I don't think that's the case either. I do think that Milwaukee has gotten a lot of attention for being a very good team. Maybe they're not as sexy as the Lakers. I mean, the Clippers are as good a team, and I don't think they're getting as much attention either. Maybe that's just the personality of Kawhi Leonard and the fact that Paul George is not necessarily a superstar, at least not in terms of popularity is concerned. You look at Milwaukee and the quality of their record and everything else, and I think they're getting just enough attention. They're getting plenty of attention. You know, as far as the win is concerned, you know, I was thinking about it last night, and I did kind of, I was a little bit of a downer about it, because it was an exciting win, because it was a big win, and I should have, you know, kind of built that up a little bit more. It was a good win. I'm not so sure that it indicates that Miami is a capable opponent of knocking off the Milwaukee Bucks in the playoffs. They're a very good team. I also think they have something there. I think they have the personnel together to make things difficult. And we haven't really seen anything. Maybe that's my own failing, is that I see the regular season record and I look at how good Milwaukee has been. The margin of victory for them has been historically high. And the reality is that, they're a very good team. And maybe they also haven't really achieved anything either. They haven't really proven themselves on this big a stage as the postseason, that is. And so when Eric Spoelstra talks about that being a motivational factor, as he did in his pregame press conference yesterday, maybe he's onto something, and maybe that's what pushed him through the regular season. It's what's pushing them through this regular season, but it's not necessarily an indicator that they're going to be able to triumph in the postseason. You look back to maybe a different example, but the failings of the San Antonio Spurs in 2013, the fact that they lost the way they did in Game 6, obviously, and then to lose again in Game 7 after they had basically outplayed the Heat for the finals anyway. That was the impetus for them to kind of become one of the best teams of the decade. They certainly pushed themselves. They pushed the boundaries of basketball in a way that we had not seen done before, with their ball movement and everything else. They were a very, very good team in 2014. But they also had something else. They also had players there that had already achieved championship success. So it's not one thing. It's not enough to just be pissed off and emotional and say, well, you know what? We're motivated. We're pushing for something this year. You also have to know what that takes. And I don't think anybody in the Milwaukee Bucks roster has that kind of experience yet. I'm thinking about this roster right now, and who has achieved championship success in that Bucks roster? You've had every player there go on deep runs in one way or another. Kyle Korver went to the finals with the Cleveland Cavaliers. But nobody there has really been able to achieve anything of note as far as an NBA Finals performance. At least Miami has Andre Iguodala. And not just on the floor, but off the floor. His leadership is going to be a huge factor there. And I think that's a big thing to consider, is that he's definitely going to be a plus for Miami, a definite benefit. Maybe not necessarily what they were expecting. I think they were counting more on his on-the-floor contributions as a wing defender, because clearly we saw that that was part of Miami's strategy against a player like Giannis Antetokounmpo, is to throw numerous defenders at him. But his off-the-floor contributions will surely be a factor as well. In any case, I'm moving on, talking about a number of different subjects today. It's kind of an off day in between the Heat's big win and their next game of the season against the Orlando Magic. So I wanted to record a short mailbag episode, not necessarily a short one, but just take a couple of those questions that I wasn't able to address in my earlier mailbag episode of this week, because you get these questions and I've let them linger for far too long, so it's time for me to get around to answering them. This first question comes from our favorite yoga lady, Claudia, who asks, Eric Reed and John Crotty were saying that Duncan Robinson should be in the discussion for most improved player. I do love Duncan, how can you not, she adds, but I think Bam Adebayo should be most improved. What do you think? Well, Claudia, first of all, I don't like the kind of discussions about postseason awards, because the criteria seems to change so completely, and there's no way of really gauging this. And you know, the rather sizable and obvious elephant in the room is that this is also subjective, and one voter's opinion, and I don't get a vote, unfortunately, is, you know, obviously so subjective. They have their own criteria, they have their own feelings as to who and what should be determining factors in the most improved player award. Is it just somebody who makes a leap from a very bad player to an okay player? Is it somebody who leaps into superstardom? And I think that's the criteria that a lot of people are using. You look at some of the past season awards, I'll just go through the past few ones. Pascal Siakam, he was last year's winner. Victor Oladipo the year before that. Giannis Antetokounmpo before that. CJ McCollum. Our own Jimmy Butler in 2014-15. Goran Dragic before that, when he was the third team All-NBA player. Paul George. Ryan Anderson and Kevin Love. That's over the last 10 years. And I think that's worth noting here, because with the exception of Anderson, who was a middling player in 2000, before that his award, and became a contributor to a championship caliber team and a playoff team in the Orlando Magic, the award had basically gone to just players who made a sizable leap. Aaron Brooks in 2009-2010, nobody remembers him really. Danny Granger, he made a big leap. Hito Turkoglu from before that. Monte Ellis was never quite a star. Boris Diaw, I mean, he was a role player on the 7 seconds or less Suns team. So not necessarily indicative of a superstar leap, but over the last 10 years, that's that criteria, is you have to be an okay player and then transform into a superstar. And unfortunately, Duncan Robinson does not qualify for that. As much as I think Duncan might be as responsible as Jimmy or Bam Adebayo, specifically offensively, his impact is as great as theirs. I just don't know that he's going to get that kind of consideration around the league. I don't think Bam Adebayo is going to be getting any consideration either. Maybe he'll get some. I think he'll certainly be in the running for All-NBA defense. I think he'll probably be at least a second team, maybe a third team selection. I can't see him being a first team selection, because I think there are too many other players that are well established as great defensive players, and Bam's still coming into his own in that regard. But either way, let's say an all-defensive selection will be in his future. I just don't know that he's viewed as a kind of superstar either. Maybe. I also can't help but have my own bias, considering that we saw potential from him last year and that it's just being realized now as a result of getting more playing time. So I'm not sure if the other voters will see that. There's been a lot of national publicity towards Bam. Obviously, he was an all-star. I think last night's performance against the Bucks certainly strengthens his case. But I'm, you know, he's also a player that does so many little things well. They're not exactly the kind of sexy plays, sexy performances, gaudy numbers that attract voters. So if I had to guess, I think Bam Adebayo is probably in the running. He'll get some kind of consideration, but not necessarily enough to win the award. But I agree that Duncan Robinson probably should be in the discussion, because I mean, you consider what he's done. I mean, he wasn't even a factor last year. He was barely on the roster. He was a G League player. He's not just transformed from a G League player into a role player in the NBA. He's the best NBA shooter on the planet right now. That is something to consider. He's coming off his screens. He's such a dangerous weapon from the perimeter. He can do so many things. And the fact that, yes, he is getting exploited defensively, that's probably going to take away some of the shine. But the reality is that as his shooting has improved, as he's become more of a force offensively, he certainly should be getting kind of the kind of consideration I think he deserves as a most improved player. But it seems unlikely. That's okay. I don't think it really matters to him. I'm sure he likes the consideration. He's already gotten some notoriety by being invited to the three-point shootout during the All-Star weekend. I'm sure it's enough for him. And to continue winning, I think, is probably more important than anything else for him. I'll get into some more questions about what Jimmy Butler's best role should be on this team and more. You're listening to Locked On Heat. If you've been a listener of this podcast, I'm sure you've heard all the great advertisers that work with Locked On to reach sports fans. But what you may not know is that Locked On Heat is a great way for your local business to reach passionate Heat fans just like you. Unlike any other podcast, Locked On gives your local company the unique ability to reach local podcast listeners all over Miami-Dade County. Not just any podcast listener, a Locked On podcast listener. If your company wants to connect with Heat fans around the world in a predominantly male audience that is well-educated with disposable income, then let's put your company right here on this Locked On podcast. Local fans love to support local businesses. Text the word advertising to 33777 or visit lockedonpodcast.com/advertising and let us know who you are. We'll get our team to help your team achieve Locked On advertising success. Once again, text the word advertising to 33777 or visit lockedonpodcast.com/advertising. We look forward to hearing from you. Mailbag staying open with some questions about DeMarcus Cousins, Jay Crowder, Jimmy Butler, and more. But let's start off with this first question that comes from Chris, who writes in about Jimmy Butler, specifically saying, do you think the trend of the Miami Heat winning games in which Butler isn't scoring well simply because other players can score on this team, but no one can facilitate and defend at the perimeter, among other things like him? So I think he's asking, what do you think of the Heat winning games? Maybe I copied and pasted it wrong, but I think this is the bulk of the question is just my take on what Jimmy does as far as, you know, his varied roles there on the team. It's almost like, Chris continues, when he puts everything into that and the scoring is everywhere else, the team thrives. Well, I'm kind of trying to read in between the lines here, Chris. I'm sorry if I misspoke or if I misunderstood the bulk of the question here. But my feeling is that you're questioning why Miami's able to win games even when Jimmy Butler isn't necessarily scoring as much. And you're absolutely right in that. I kind of looked at an arbitrary number there and looked at Jimmy's performances this season. I could have gone back further to his role in Philadelphia, but, you know, it doesn't really matter. Anything that he did prior to his tenure here in Miami. In Philadelphia, he wasn't supposed to be a lead scorer, neither in Minnesota and Chicago. It's so different. His role changed so much from a role player to just kind of earning his way on Tom Thibodeau's roster to becoming a star, to playing alongside Dwayne Wade and Rajon Rondo during the 3 Alpha era. Oof. So I looked at his year specifically in Miami, and I looked at an arbitrary number, 20 points. And in the 20 games in which he scored less than 20 points, the Heat actually have a very good record of 14-6. On those occasions, he's actually put up 7 assists or more 12 times and 6 assists on 3 other occasions. So a total of 15 games there in which he's put up at least 6 assists or more. His record in those games, 11-4. So there is certainly something to consider there when you look at the fact that Jimmy Butler does not have to score a lot, does not have to score over 20 points. And more importantly, I think, is that he's dishing the ball. He's looking to be a creator for others. And we saw that, I think, a lot more earlier in the season where that was the role he seemed more comfortable in. And it's kind of set a template there. Like, I know he's been criticized for not being more of a go-to scorer, not being more aggressive, more just potent as a scorer. But the reality is that he also set this kind of tone earlier in the season when he was looking at this team. And I think it's something that gets overlooked a lot. For all the talk about whether he is or isn't a locker room cancer, whether he is a terrible teammate, a terrible human being, or anything like that, he actually went in there, I think, with a strategy of saying, it's important for me to get everybody else going. not just a burgeoning superstar in Bam Adebayo, but an up-and-coming player in Tyler Hero, a guy like Kendrick Nunn and Duncan Robinson, who's just trying to prove their way in the NBA. So many other guys here on this roster, and I think Jimmy did a phenomenal job of trying to get them engaged early on in the season, knowing that it is a long grind and that you have to have these players step up at some point or another. And it's paid off because every one of those players, even guys like Kelly Olynyk, even newer players like Jay Crowder, I mean, all these guys have had key moments at some point throughout the season. Myers had a big game. Look, you could go down the roster, and again, everybody's had to contribute. And I think a lot of that is because Jimmy set a tone. And it's worked out because this roster is one that is capable of passing the ball effectively. You have a number of guys that can space the floor and shoot at a very high level. That's fine. But I think Jimmy, as a superstar, willing to share the ball and take over games as a scorer on occasion, has been a huge factor for Miami. And so I like the fact that Jimmy is capable and willing to be a contributor offensively without necessarily having to be a go-to scorer. I think he still gets to the line quite a bit. I think he also does a phenomenal job of that. But his passing has been such an underrated force of his offensive repertoire. And he's just been using it much more effectively than ever before, I think. He's creating points for others. He's creating opportunities for others. He's getting them to be, to take ownership over their respective impact on this game. And I think that's a huge factor. I think it's such an important thing for the team's leader in Jimmy Butler to be a guy who doesn't care necessarily about his stats, but more about winning. And a big component of that is making sure that everybody is able to contribute and feels comfortable doing so at some point or another during the course of the season. So, Chris, thank you for your question. I really do appreciate it. And I was glad I was able to take a deeper dive into those numbers there, because you know that he's a good passer. You know he hasn't necessarily been a huge gaudy scorer, but I didn't realize how impactful his passing had been. Like, I mean, for him to be that kind of a player, and to be able to pass the ball as much as he did and still contribute to winning at such a high level, I think it speaks huge volumes about what Jimmy's role has been on this team this year and what kind of a superstar he is. My next question comes from Jay Jack, who writes, is it possible or even a good idea for the Heat to look at Cousins, DeMarcus Cousins that is, if he may be able to return this season? So he would be able to return this season onto a roster, a playoff roster, because he was waived before a certain deadline. And so he's eligible to join a team as of now. As long as you are, if you've been waived before the deadline, you're still capable of making a roster. You don't necessarily have to sign with a team. That's why a guy like Dion Waiters can be considered by the Los Angeles Lakers, because they can add him to that roster and he can contribute right away. Unfortunately, the reason why DeMarcus was waived was because he can't play this season. He's not going to. He's still rehabbing his leg. He's not at 100%. He's far from it. And he's not going to be a factor for any team this year, Miami or others. He also likes Los Angeles from what we've heard. He's still working out with a team. Frank Vogel spoke highly of him, and the Lakers have granted DeMarcus access to their training facility so that he can continue to rehabilitate. And I think that's a good move from the team and for the player, just to kind of get some kind of comfort, some stability as far as his rehab is concerned. I mean, he's on his fourth team now, right? Is it his fourth team over the past 3 years? He went from Sacramento to New Orleans to Golden State to the Lakers. For all the talk about Boogie's reputation and his impact as a player and his demeanor off the court, it's been a weird, weird travel for him. It's been a weird, you know, path for him to this point. And so I'm hoping that he'll be able to make a full comeback at some point. And I'd love to see him in Miami. I think this would be there's no question about his talent. He's got the ability. He was considering Miami or Los Angeles earlier in the season. He chose to sign with the Lakers, and that's probably the better move for him. Although I would have loved for him to play alongside this roster. I think it would have been very interesting. But I'm hoping that he'll consider Miami at some point in the future, and I'm also optimistic that he'll be able to make a full return, and I think it'll be a good fit here. I'm curious to see whether or not they can help rehabilitate his image on and off the court, and I think that's the point where he's at right now, is that, you know, he had that one-year experiment with Golden State to see if they could compete for a title that did not. He was injured during the course of that season, unfortunately for him, and it just hasn't worked out as far as any of his moves, whether, you know, forcing a trade, whether opting not to re-sign with the New Orleans Pelicans, things of that sort. It's been a disastrous turn of events for him. So right now, I think the next step for him is to probably find a team where he can contribute at a high level, where he can kind of rehabilitate his on and off the court image. And I think Miami, you know, with their well-established track record of getting the most out of players and helping, you know, rehabilitate and resurrect, that's the term that James Johnson used when he was here from, you know, visiting with Minnesota, was that the Heat helped resurrect his career. I think that's where Boogie's probably at right now. And I imagine that he'll probably get some, he'll probably get a call from Miami at some point this offseason and see if he's healthy and willing to contribute and take a veteran, a minimum veteran deal so he can just kind of be a factor next season and beyond that. But we'll see how it goes over the offseason. I'm sure there'll be some contact between the two, the team and the player at some point. But I'll keep you posted if I hear anything. Heat Lifer asks, will Jay Crowder end up being the best part of the Justice Winslow trade? You know, that's a tough one. As I said in the first segment, I do think that there's a very big role for Andre Iguodala to play here, both on and off the court. Crowder has been hugely impactful on the court. His three-point shooting has been something that I don't think anybody expected would be at this high and this prolific. So I like what Crowder can do. I also think that as a free agent, he's probably making as big a push for his next contract as possible, and it's a contract that he's not going to get from Miami. He's just going to be too expensive a player to keep. As much as I'd like for him to stay in Miami and continue to be a role player here, that doesn't seem very likely. And so I think he's making a push to get that next deal, his best chance at a deal. So that's I think partly what's motivating him. That's not to say that he isn't. One of the things that I've kind of read about Crowder is that he's a guy that plays well on good teams. Obviously, he was struggling to find his role in Memphis. He was really out of sorts when he was with the Cleveland Cavaliers, even though they wound up competing for a title later that year. You know, he needs to be relied on, and I think that's a big part of it. He needs to be used in kind of, you know, he wants to feel like he's a contributor to the team's success. And he was part of a hell of a rotation with the Boston Celtics a few years ago, which is where he had his best seasons. He was able to be a very good contributor in Utah, and they moved him in the Mike Conley trade. And now that he's with Miami, he's been an incredible factor here. I mean, I think it would be great for him to re-sign with the team. But at the same time, I can understand why he's pursuing another deal, and it's probably going to be elsewhere. So as far as the best part of the Winslow trade is concerned, I mean, Solomon Hill isn't going to be a factor. Andre Iguodala is probably only going to be playing this year and next. You know, he signed that two-year extension with a team option for the third year, and I just don't see that he's going to be retained for that much longer. You know, they've also talked about the possibility that he could be traded as a result of his deal. I think Andre and the team have a pretty good understanding that you know, he wants to continue playing. He wants to play for a contender, but he also wants to be able to finish his career on his terms. And I think he's earned that responsibility and right. And I think at some point they'll probably facilitate a trade for him to go back to Golden State so that he can, you know, be where he achieved championship success. So I guess Crowder, even if he's, I mean, let's consider this for a second. Would Crowder have to be a supremely good player, what, averaging 12 to 15 points, 38% shooting from three-point range over the next 2 months? And would that outweigh whatever we'll get out of Andre Iguodala this season and next? I mean, even if Andre is just an okay contributor, you'd have to look over that length of time and say that he's probably going to be, you know, the better part of that trade, although Crowder might be more effective over a shorter span. So It's a tough question to answer. For now, Jay Crowder has been fun. He's been great to watch. He's been great to talk to, and I really enjoy having him on the team. But I could say the same thing about Iguodala, and I think there's going to be a role for him to play down when the playoffs go into a deeper run, and he's got a clear role that he sees for himself to fill, and I think he's going to be able to do so. That's my thinking on the subject, and we haven't seen greatness from Andre yet. He hasn't been as prolific. I don't think that's his role either. I don't think he wants to be that guy. He's going to push the tempo. He's going to bring the ball up court. He's going to snatch rebounds, play perimeter defense, and do a pretty good job of all those things. And I think he's going to be able to continue contributing in those regards. And we'll see what happens when the playoffs come around, where he's much more comfortable and where we've seen some great performances from him in the past. Steve Koladikis writes, keep reading that Heat fans continually pump up Kendrick as the rookie of the year, Kendrick Nunn, that is. I like the guy, but it isn't even in Zion's stratosphere. Okay. I can see that next season, Tyler Herro would surpass Kendrick Nunn either way. Who do you think are the top five rooks this season? Wow. So to Steve's point there, of the two, either Kendrick Nunn or Tyler Herro, who is going to be the most impactful player for the Heat next season? Well, it's probably going to be Tyler. I think he's just going to get more opportunity. I think his floor spacing is greater than Kendrick's is. And while you like Kendrick's aggressive shot-taking ability, I think Tyler can do a pretty good job creating offense for himself. I think he's a better ball handler and distributor. I think they're both probably equally bad defensively as far as their positioning is concerned. And while they both try hard, and I think I've seen improvement from both of them over the course of the season, I'm not sure that either one is sufficiently better than others. I'll have to go and do a deeper dive as far as the numbers are concerned and see if anything pops out as far as what their impact defensively and the metrics, what they might have to say about their respective performances. But if you're looking at Kendrick Nunn or Tyler Herro and which one of them has a better chance at reaching superstardom, I don't think either of them do. But I think Tyler has greater capacity for growth in his respective role. I think you look at him being the kind of floor spacer, shot creator for himself and others, and I think he's going to be better at that than what it is Kendrick is doing right now, which is getting a bucket, aggressively going to the basket at every opportunity and trying to score for the team. So that's my feeling, is that it's a slight edge in Tyler's favor there. As far as the overall rookies of the year, well, I think Morant is pretty clearly in the favorite, at least as far as voters are concerned. Most people probably think that his impact this year, not just because they're pushing the Memphis Grizzlies into pseudo-playoff contention, but just his overall individual numbers have been fantastic. He's been a lot of fun to watch. He's made the transition a lot more quickly than I expected and that a lot of people expected. So I think that's it. As far as the obvious rookie of the year choice right now is probably Ja. But you also have to look at Zion Williams and he's having a hell of a year. Phenomenal numbers in a very short amount of playing time. And I think that's obviously going to be the knock on him. But, I mean, in the three games since the All-Star break, Zion is averaging 27.3 points, 5.7 rebounds, and 2.7 assists while shooting 56.4% from the field. That's pretty good. There's no way around that. His numbers, his production has been ridiculous. He just hasn't played enough games. He's probably the second best rookie right now as far as, I mean, he's the best rookie in the class, I think, period. But he's the second best rookie in terms of the Rookie of the Year award, and that's pretty clear. Kendrick, by most accounts, seems to be fitting in that third span. I think he's the third best rookie in terms of the Rookie of the Year award. He's played there from day one. You know, he had that stretch right before the All-Star break where he had the sore Achilles and he was out for a couple games, but he's been playing. He's been a go-to factor. You look at all the other teams and Memphis, yeah, they've won some games. New Orleans has struggled a lot. You look at all the other rookies, they're not necessarily on winning teams either. Kendrick is the only guy on this list, I think, who is a contributor, a big-time contributor, a regular one on a winning team that has serious playoff aspirations. Give credit to Morant for doing the same thing, but I think that Kendrick has also filled that role pretty admirably. So he's the third rookie in this list. I just think that he's had some great production over the course of the season, and he's been a real surprise. I don't think anybody really expected him to fill that kind of role. I certainly didn't. I know I was critical over the summer league, although not as critical as Wes Goldberg, if you remember that correctly. I just didn't see that game, his game translating there, and it's been fun to watch his growth over the course of the season. And while I think he does not have a high ceiling as a individual player in the NBA, he's also filled his role pretty well with Miami this past season. After that, the list gets really, really tough. I mean, you could give votes to Rui Hachimura. He's been better than a lot of people expected. I always liked Rui's ability. There is no infallible way of projecting what an NBA player's career will be like. You get into the right situation with the right coaching staff and the right work ethic and the right tools, and you can achieve stardom. I mean, I don't think anybody had Duncan Robinson as a productive player on a playoff contending team. And yet here we are. So I like Rui Hachimura. He'd be my fourth best rookie as far as this list is concerned. And then after that, you got to give some consideration to Brendan Clark. He's done a phenomenal job with the Memphis Grizzlies as a really solid role player. Darius Garland's having some big games there as of late for the Cleveland Cavaliers. I think a lot of people remember his impact against the Heat. Kevin Porter Jr. had a really big game against Miami, but I don't think he's been doing that very consistently over the course of the season. You also look at Terrence Davis, and his contributions to winning for the Toronto Raptors have been huge. I mean, they're just getting so much production from everybody, including my guy OG Anunoby. But Davis has been a factor as well off the bench, and he's been a nice player for Toronto. So it's tough. Kobe White probably should get some consideration too. I'm trying to think off the top of my head there. I don't see anybody else that's really stepped up that much. So if I had to guess who the fifth best player here, or the fifth as far as the Rookie of the Year race is concerned, I don't know. I really don't have a clear fifth there. I don't think it matters. I think this is Jaws' award to win, with Zion getting some serious consideration there by the time the season winds down. I'll answer your question about what Miami's record will be like at the end of the season. You're listening to Locked On Heat. Remember to listen to and subscribe to new and archived episodes of Locked On Heat on Himalaya, as well as on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. If you're in iTunes, please leave a rating and review, especially if it's a good one. So I got a couple of questions here that are along the same lines. Jay Jack also writes, do you think the Heat can get to 50 wins this season? And Jay Folk Hip writes, what do you think the Heat's record will be after all of 82 games? Now, similar questions, not quite the same. Heat's record is currently 39-22. They've got 21 games left. Of those 21, 11 games are at home. 10 are on the road. So they've obviously had their struggles on the road. There's no way of predicting exactly what their record will be like during those road games. They're not against quality opponents overall. Road games include two at Charlotte against a very inferior team, one in New York, Detroit, Chicago, and Washington. So six games against sub 500 teams. Obviously, they've already lost to the Knicks and Wizards. I think they have a chance of winning all six of those games, but you know, this is Miami we're talking about, and we're not quite sure whether or not they're going to continue to make the improvements that we've seen over the last three games. They've also got games in New Orleans, Milwaukee, Indiana, and Boston. Those, with the exception of the Pelicans game, you almost have to consider that they probably will lose all four. Indiana is a very tough place for Miami to win. You've got the TJ Warren factor. Milwaukee's clearly going to be looking for some revenge. They're going to look to exact some revenge there, and you wonder whether or not Miami's going to be able to duplicate their incredible defense against Giannis Antetokounmpo. The Celtics have had our number in two losses this season, so you wonder whether or not Miami is going to be able to kind of find a way to overcome that, and whether or not they can stop Kemba Walker. Now with their added versatile wing players and Jay Crowder and Andre Iguodala, you wonder if they've got enough personnel now to make an impact as far as Kemba's pick-and-roll shooting is concerned. As far as the home games are concerned, you've got 11 again against Orlando, Charlotte, Chicago, the Knicks, Oklahoma City, Denver, Phoenix, Indiana, Detroit, Boston, and Toronto. The Toronto one being the last game of the year when it probably won't matter much. You look at those 21 games, and let's say of the 10 road games, they'll go 5-5. They could probably go 6-4. They can go 7-3 with the only losses really against Milwaukee, Indiana, and Boston. But that's not how it works. They could win against Milwaukee. They could win against Indiana for sure. And they could lose to the Detroit Pistons, even though they're going through a rebuilding year yet again. You never know in the NBA. You never know if it's a back-to-back, if it's a different set of circumstances where a player might be hurt. A lot depends on the return of Myers Leonard and Tyler Herro, because they've been such huge factors for Miami's defense and offense, respectively. So I'm going to peg their 10 road games at 5-5. If that's the case, they're already going to be at 44-22, just if they continue with their record as it currently stands. Of their 11 home games, there's some quality opponents there, including the Orlando Magic, who have had their number Oklahoma City, who's been playing at a very high level, Denver Nuggets, Phoenix Suns, Indiana, Boston, and Toronto. So Miami's been very, very good offensively at home and defensively, I think. It's tough to predict how they'll do at home against some pretty good opponents here. I don't know if they're going to be able to contain and maintain, rather, the kind of hot shooting that they've been able to put up at home. And of those 11 home games, there's some tough ones there. I mean, Oklahoma City in particular is the toughest opponent, I think, of that stretch, although Denver is playing at a very high level as well. So, I mean, those are some definite challenges, Boston especially. Let's say of the 11 home games, even the last game of the season, where, again, who knows if they'll be playing for anything at all. They might be playing for home court advantage. Of those 11 home games, they'll go 8-3. So you're looking at 5-5 for the 10 remaining road games, 8-3 at home. So 13 more wins over the course of the season. 13-8 over the last 21 games. It's pretty high. I also think they will achieve that, and if that's the case, the final record for this year will be 52-30. A lot higher than I projected. I did not think that they would be a 50-win team. I think they were going to be about 48, 49. They might still wind up being around that team, that level. And that's not necessarily bad. I think it's still a very good team at 48 wins, and it might be enough to have home court advantage in the Eastern Conference. That seems a little unlikely, but we'll see whether or not they can actually achieve that. But right now, my prediction is a 52-30 record for Miami. That'd be one of the better seasons in Heat history, and a fantastic achievement considering everything that they've gone through and the fact that they're rebuilding this year after, you know, with Jimmy Butler on their roster and everything else, and they've had a phenomenal season. So Miami will be hosting Orlando on Wednesday. That should be a really good matchup. Orlando's banged up a little bit, and Miami's playing at such a high level. Then they'll go on the road for a few games, so it's a good test for them, a good way to get some good closure, to kind of send yourself off there with some high spirits, even when you have a couple of players that are you know, key contributors that are still injured and won't be available to play. It's going to be a fun matchup. I'll try to record a podcast from the American Airlines Arena again, so hopefully I'll do a better job of it this time. But that's all for today. You can connect with me on Twitter using the hashtag AskLOHeat or email me at LockedOnHeat@gmail.com. I'm David Ramil signing off and thanking you as always for your support. Yeah! Wrap it up, B.